This week, leading up to Prisoner Justice Day on August 10th and Prisoner Justice Week in Montreal, many are speaking out about different criticisms of the prison systems. It's important to also focus on alternatives to the current prison industrial complex and punitive and discriminatory legal systems that we see around us currently. Transformative justice has emerged as an approach to seeking transformative forms of justice and community accountability that addresses the root causes for violence in the first place. I spoke with Victoria Law about transformative justice.
Hi, my name is Victoria Law. I'm a writer, photographer, and mother. I have been working with people in prison since I was in high school, and I've specifically been focusing on women's prison issues and women's prisoner resistance since the early 2000s. In the course of my working with people inside women's prisons, I've, come to realize that if we're talking about prison abolition, we can't be talking about abolition without developing methods and means to address harm that has been caused by so many people. And so that's one of the reasons why I'm really interested in initiatives around transformative justice.
Great. And so could you briefly explain a few of the principles behind transformative justice and where this approach to justice originated?
So some of the ideas behind transformative justice is that there are conditions that allow harm to occur. So violence or other forms of harm don't happen in a vacuum. And these conditions need to be addressed and transformed. And transformative justice looks at providing both immediate safety for people who have been harmed or might be harmed and long-term healing and reparations, within their communities. So it means stopping immediate abuse, making a commitment to not engage in further abuse, and offering reparations for past abuse. So it basically looks at, what is the whole picture, not just what happened in this immediate incident. What are the structural problems that have helped cause this behavior, and how do we transform these conditions so that this doesn't keep happening?
And transformative justice can be viewed as an approach to transforming the way we address conflicts and violence within communities who themselves are experiencing forms of systemic violence through discrimination in the legal system and over policing. So can you give a few examples of the ways in which that police are not viewed as protectors for many poor communities and communities of color?
Well, one of the most recent stark examples that we've seen has been the whole Trayvon Martin being killed by George Zimmerman case in Florida. So it took the police, I think, something like 40 days to arrest and charge George Zimmerman with killing Trayvon Martin, who was a 17-year-old unarmed black kid, walking down the street. And if we look at the history of how police work, they often don't see people of color, low-income people of color, people who fit certain profiles, as being worthy of protection. Here in New York City, the New York Police Department is facing 5 federal lawsuits challenging its stop-and-frisk policies. Stop-and-frisk, for listeners who don't know, is the New York City Police Department policy of stopping and being able to search people, quote-unquote, randomly in the street. And its statistics have shown that of the almost 686,000 people they stopped in 2011, 84% of them were black or Latino, even though blacks and Latinos make up roughly half of the city's population. So it's this idea that, there are some bodies or some racialized groups that are, more at risk of police violence and police abuse than others. Again, we also see that queer people, especially queer people of color, are less likely to be subject to police protection and more likely to be abused by police or investigated by police, even when they are the victims of violence. So in the United States, there are a couple of cases that jump to mind. One is the case of Cece McDonald, who is a African-American trans woman living in Minneapolis. And she was walking down the street to the grocery store with some friends when she was physically attacked by some people standing outside a bar who apparently took offense that she was a African-American trans woman. And during the course of the attack, glass was smashed into her face. She was, she was brutally attacked, and she fought back. And at the end of that, one person of the assailants was dead, and the police came, and they immediately charged her with killing one of her assailants, but they didn't charge anyone in the group with having smashed glass into her vase or provoking this attack. So, again, we can see how the police don't protect certain people from certain communities or people of certain sexual orientations or racial identities.
And how do prisons and policing protect those in power instead of protecting vulnerable individuals who don't necessarily have power?
Well, as I mentioned before, we can see how police target certain ethnicities and certain populations and certain more marginalized populations who don't have power. And I want to point out a recent revelation. So, at least in the U.S., a 2011 FBI report that was obtained recently through the Freedom of Information Act said that agents have actually signed off on over 5,000 crimes that year that were perpetrated by FBI informants. So basically they were saying, well, it's okay for you to commit harm because you're doing something back for us, you know, whereas if those were 5,000-something crimes perpetrated by people who were not, say, on the FBI payroll or giving them information, they would most likely be prosecuted. So we can kind of see how the legal system kind of turns a blind eye to certain types of harm committed by certain types of people. And then when we look at, say, the George Zimmerman trial and what a guilty verdict would and wouldn't have done, we can kind of see how policing and prisons don't actually protect or make reparations towards people who have been harmed. So if Zimmerman had been found guilty, it would have added another body to the 2.4 million people already behind bars in the United States. But it wouldn't have brought Trayvon Martin back to his family. It would not have undone the rewriting of his life that happened, both in the media and in the courtroom, that cast him as a villain in his own murder. It wouldn't have stopped the prevalent and systemic fear of young black and brown men that led George Zimmerman to follow and kill Trayvon Martin. Like, this didn't happen in a vacuum. It wouldn't address the need to change the ways we talk about race and racism in this country. A guilty verdict wouldn't have stopped anyone else from shooting a young black man because they were scared or because they were relying on racist stereotypes. A guilty verdict wouldn't make any of our communities and loved ones any safer from gun violence or racist violence. And quite frankly, a guilty verdict wouldn't even make George Zimmerman rethink his irrational fear of young black men. It would just mean that he goes to prison for X amount of time, and he sits in prison, and he stews, and he thinks about how unfair this is, and nothing in a guilty verdict would make him be like, why did I think it was a good idea to follow this young man, like, home, you know, like, on the street and confront him? Like, what's going on in my mind? Like, none of that would have happened, you know, under the current legal system.
Putting someone in prison doesn't transform a perpetrator, someone who's committed violence for whatever reasons. And I'm wondering if you could speak to ways in which transformative justice offers alternatives to that.
Well, one of the things that transformative justice does is it holds people who've committed harm accountable. So that can look like many different things. And there's not a, unlike the police and prison system, there's not a one-size-fits-all model. So let's say in the case of George Zimmerman, you know, transformative justice might include him having to go through, like, some, you know, extended, I don't know if you want to call it counseling or therapy or workshops or some sort of thing that is a little bit more political than just soul-searching about, like, what is happening, you know, here where you think that young black men are these dangerous people that need to be followed and shot. Like, what's going on in terms of this irrational fear? Like, what are the roots of, you know, like, this extreme racism that you have? Like, what's going on that you think that it's okay to be following, you know, people with guns? You know, like, what kind of reparations could be made to Trayvon Martin's family, you know, from the person who did so much harm, not just in that moment, but in the, like, weeks and months and year that followed, in which they had to see their son maligned over and over and over in the press and have his life picked apart. So transformative justice would address some of these issues. And it would also hopefully start, you know, like, more dialogue around why do we fear, you know, certain body people? Why do we fear certain races? You know, like, why do we think that the solution for our neighborhood watches is following people with guns? you know, or following, you know, like following people, like what about other de-escalation techniques? Like what could have looked differently if, you know, like neighborhood watches, say, were trained to, you know, like de-escalate situations, not escalate them to the point where somebody is getting killed.
Mm-hmm. And could you speak to how transformative justice approaches may also offer a way to address the fact that many people from poor communities or communities of color are themselves the ones found in prison? So maybe with working outside of the justice system or without the cops, how that also could address over-incarceration of communities of color and poor communities?
Well, I think one of the things that we have to remember when there are, you know, with the over-incarceration of poor communities and communities of color is that oftentimes people are being incarcerated for things, for actions that are not necessarily violent. They may cause harm, just like somebody's drug addiction causes harm not just to themselves, but to all of, you know, to their loved ones. But we can see transformative justice being a way that people can also work towards healing not only themselves, but their families and their communities. So right now what we're seeing is that, especially in low-income communities of color, is that when a person goes to prison, it affects not only themselves, but their families. So if a man goes to prison and he's, say, in a family situation where he's got a wife or a girlfriend and some children, then suddenly they're left without somebody who is bringing in some money. They're left without a caregiver. They're left without, you know, there's a huge hole in the fabric of the family. Oftentimes in the United States, we see that when a mother goes to prison, oftentimes she was the primary caregiver and sole breadwinner of that family. So immediately that family gets ripped apart and children sent to foster care, you know, and she risks losing legal custody of her children and not being able to see them ever again. So if we look at transformative justice as a way to not only look at what, you know, like look at the immediate action that happened. So say that somebody got arrested for being in a fight, you know, like let's look at what the root causes of that fight are, you know, like what's going on here. Like let's have both parties address this. And let's also work with the person who was harmed or the people who were harmed to say like, well, what do you need to come out of this? You know, like, what, you know, like, what do you need to, for the harm to be repaired? And then also work with the other person to say, like, well, what's going on here? You know, like, what are the root causes? Maybe there are some anger issues or violence issues or ways that you can perhaps learn to react differently to certain provocations so that you don't end up in the criminal legal system. So I think what we can see with transformative justice is a way for people to be able to address not only, again, that, you know, in the moment action that often leads to the police and prisons, but also what are the underlying causes so that this doesn't happen again and that you can start to transform not only yourself, but like, you know, like also how you relate to your family, your community, to other people, and hopefully, you know, vice versa as well.
And there are many groups around the so-called United States of America who are currently using transformative justice approaches, community accountability processes to address gendered violence in their communities. Could you speak about some of these groups doing this work and how they are approaching transformative justice?
Sure. Well, one of the groups in New York City, actually, is the Audre Lorde Project, which is an organization of LGBTQ people of color, and they actually started a few years ago something that they called the Safe Neighborhood Campaign, looking at the alarming amount of violence perpetrated against LGBTQ folks of color, often by other folks of color in their community. And rather than calling the police in and exacerbating the problem, which then means that the police come and perhaps they arrest the person that's been causing harm, perhaps they arrest the person who was harmed, perhaps they arrest everybody, but basically it invites more violence and more brutality into the neighborhood. They decided to launch a campaign which works with other people in the community to start providing safe havens from sexist or homophobic or transphobic attacks, whether they be physical attacks or in some cases verbal assaults. So in the first phase, they identified restaurants, businesses, community groups, like physical spaces, and approach them about being visible safe havens for those who are being threatened with or fleeing from violence. So it could be like a sign on the window that's like, this is a safe space. And so then if you are a person walking down the street in that neighborhood and you feel like you are threatened with violence, or, you know, like you're experiencing violence, there is a safe place for you to go. And then the campaign also incorporates an educational component where the people of that designated safe space, the owners, it's safe, it's a business, the owners of that business, the employees of that business, and other community members have trainings on, you know, like homophobia, transphobia, and de-escalation techniques. So, like, if somebody, like, comes into the store or, you know, pizzeria or business and it's just like, hey, I'm, you know, really scared because there's this going on outside, you know, or if they're in a restaurant or a shop and somebody starts saying homophobic or transphobic things, everybody associated with that space knows how to address that and knows, like, what to look out for. Like, hey, that crack actually isn't okay here. Like, you can't say those things here. And they also know how to start de-escalating it. And if we want to, like, kind of imagine, you know, how transformative justice might play out, if we look at the case of CC McDonald in Minneapolis walking down the street, what if the people working at that bar had been trained to recognize, you know, transphobic language and behavior as like a warning sign and a red alarm, and had been trained in how to go out and de-escalate it? So when CC McDonald's assailant started saying all sorts of racist and transphobic things to her, what would have happened if two bartenders or bouncers or whatever had come out and been like, hey, you know, this is not okay language, you know, like, we don't do that here, like, that's not okay, you gotta, you know, settle down, you can't say that. And what if they'd been trained to effectively de-escalate the situation? Would CC McDonald have been assaulted? Would this other person have died? Would CC McDonald now be in prison? Like, you know, we have to think about what these kinds of possibilities are. But with transformative justice, oftentimes there's not the, like, and then this is what happened, as opposed to when there's an assault and an arrest and an imprisonment. So it's hard to then point to, say, something that the Audre Lorde Project has done to be like, and then instead of this attack happening and this person fighting back and the police getting involved and these people going to prison, it's like, well, maybe there was something and it got shut down pretty quickly and everybody got to walk away with very little harm being done.
And what would you say are some of the most challenging aspects to using transformative justice to address violence?
The most challenging aspects, and it might discourage people from trying to implement transformative justice techniques as opposed to relying on the criminal legal system, is that it takes a lot of time. Like, there isn't the instantaneous result that policing in prisons does, which is you arrest somebody, you go through a legal process, and then you lock them up or you don't lock them up, but it's done. Like, it's a process that addresses underlying issues, you know, which takes time and might actually, and it's, you know, for people who are involved in it, it is a commitment to actually look at not only what's going on in their own lives, but how systematic structures may have impacted their own lives to have led them to cause the harm. And then what do they need to do to both change themselves and then also work to change these structural concerns. So it is a process, and it's a slow process, and sometimes it can feel like, you know, like this huge, unwieldy process, but I think it's really necessary if we're looking at having a world where we're not locking millions of people up in cages.